This is Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman with Howard Wilkinson. The federal government reopened last week after the partial shutdown ended after 16 days. Congress approved a plan that funds the government through mid-January and extends the Treasury Department's ability to borrow money through early February. Now Congress turns its attention to a conference committee that's supposed to create an actual federal budget for the first time in years. The deadline for that plan is mid-December. Joining us to discuss the shutdown and its aftermath is political junkie Ken Rudin. You can join our conversation, too. Our phone number is 513-419-7100 or email talk at wvxu.org. Again, 513-419-7100. And we're also on Facebook and Twitter. And Ken, it's pleasure to have you back on the show, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys. Great to be here.
And as always, you're going to start with a trivia question.
Well, this is an Ohio trivia question, yes. Everybody knows that no Republican has ever been elected president without winning Ohio.
True.
And that's still true. But who was the last Democrat who was elected president without winning Ohio? That's the question.
And don't answer, Howard, if you know, because we want to see if listeners know.
Oh,
but
okay.
Do you know?
Huh?
Do you know?
The last Democrat?
Yeah. To win the presidency without winning Ohio.
Yeah, I have a pretty good idea.
I told you he would, Ken.
Yeah, I know. Well, yeah, it's Howard Wilkinson. I understand that.
That's all right.
So if you think you know the answer to that, again, the last Democrat to win the presidency without winning the state of Ohio, 513-419-7100. And we'll let you think on that and talk a little bit about the shutdown in the meantime. So it's been a week since the federal government reopened after the partial shutdown. A week out now, Ken. What's the takeaway from what happened the first 16 days of October, or what didn't happen the first 16 days of October?
Well, if we're talking politically, I mean, there seems to be little question that it was the Democrats who got the big victory and the Republicans got the big defeat. We don't know about any chasm or disagreements within the Democratic Party. They seem to be all on the same page, while every day, perhaps every hour during that 16-day shutdown, all you heard about was John Boehner fighting with his Tea Party folks in the House, the Senate, Mitch McConnell and Ted Cruz at completely opposite ends of what should be done. So, and if you look, there's a Washington Post poll this week that just had Republican Party in just awful, awful numbers. Their favorable numbers were 32%, 63% opposed. It was even worse for the Tea Party. So whether that has repercussions for 2014 is another question. But right now, the Republicans didn't help themselves.
And CNN had a poll that had 63% saying they didn't want John Boehner as speaker anymore.
Yeah, and the matter of fact, not only that, yeah, the Boehner's numbers are not good. Continued Republican control of the House is not good. And even among Republicans, there was a poll out the other day that showed that among Republicans, 46% of them said that their strategy during the whole shutdown budget negotiation crisis was just a disaster. This is just about among Republicans.
You think it really threatens their control of the House?
Well, we always talk about, you know, districts that have been drawn safe in,
right,
you know, in redistricting, and a lot of that is true. And when we talk about the disaster of the 1995-1996 shutdown led by Newt Gingrich and the House Republicans back then, and everybody said the Republican Party would pay the political price. As it turned out, Republicans only lost nine seats, a net loss of nine seats back in 96.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, a year from now is a long time politically, but
right
now the Republican brand is not so good.
Let's go back to John Boehner and his speakership. There were some Tea Party conservatives who said the fight actually improved his position. If they didn't get what they want, how did that improve Speaker Boehner's position?
Well, I mean, there's no question that there are anywhere between 40 and 50, perhaps even more, Tea Party folks who just don't like the kind of accommodating way, and not everybody sees John Boehner in those terms, but the accommodating way of John Boehner and how he, you know, was really, his heart was really never in the shutdown. But he also stood firm with the Republican Party at the end. He allowed, you know, he stuck to the end. The vote at the end was really, we're still going to vote to defund and delay Obamacare. And so while maybe, you know, Boehner's heart may have not have been in it, he didn't walk away from that strategy, and he stuck with him. Now, you know, when he's assuming the Republicans get elected, reelected to control of the House in 2014, there may still be more challenges to Boehner's leadership, and who knows what's going to happen. You know, Jay, you mentioned that we may battle this all over again in January and February, and we'll see what Boehner's role is there. But for now, he doesn't seem as weak or being led by the Tea Party tiger as he did a month ago.
Yeah. It's been suggested to me that of the Tea Party caucus, a lot of that was sort of playing to their audience, you know, the criticism of Boehner. Steve Shabbat, one of the congressmen from Cincinnati, highly aligned with Tea Party, his comment was, well, I voted against it, but I'm glad it's over. And, I mean, was that real animus towards Boehner, or was that show?
Well, I think it was. Look, Shabbat goes back. Shabbat is a Tea Party guy, but Shabbat at least goes back to, you know, earlier days,
yes,
of a different kind of Republican Party in the House. But a lot of these folks who were just elected for the first time in 2010, they don't own allegiance to John Boehner. You know, Boehner's been in the House since 1991. That's a long time ago. Their allegiance is to the, you know, to the groups that elected them in 2010, and most of them are conservative, not liking the way government is run and the way the Republican Party is running Congress, or at least in the House. So a lot of them owe nothing to John Boehner. He cannot promise them anything. He cannot promise them earmarks, because a lot of Republicans just have sworn off earmarks. So there's not much that he can do to help them, and they have no, you know, unlike, you know, you cross Lyndon Johnson, you cross Sam Rayburn, even if you cross Newt Gingrich, you pay a political price. There is no political price to pay if you cross John Boehner.
Yeah.
Was there, I think I heard an NPR interview on this that actually to remove the speaker, that hasn't happened in a number of years, if ever. Is that correct?
I cannot, I do know that the last speaker defeated for re-election was 1862, and Howard was just a kid back then, but I don't think in my memory, I know there was a Republican coup after the Goldwater defeat in 64, where they got rid of some leadership in the House, but I don't remember ever a speaker being toppled by his own party.
And more than likely
by the incumbent, you know, by the incumbents in the House.
And I think the point of that interview was more than likely before it ever got to the point that he would be removed, he would actually step down first.
Right. I mean, of course, that's what happened with Jim Wright in 1989, but that was more about ethics and not about, you know, not about electing a new speaker.
You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU, and Ken started the program with the trivia question. The last Democrat to win the White House that didn't win the state of Ohio, and we got some folks that want to take a stab at that. And Rob, you're on the air.
Hi. If I remember right, I think it was Jimmy Carter.
Jimmy Carter, Ken.
No, actually, Jimmy Carter did carry Ohio. He did a very good job of he campaigned very long and hard in Ohio, and he won that state. So Carter carried it.
Somebody get this right. This is driving me crazy.
All right, Rob, thank you. And let's see. We're going to try Steve in Wyoming. Steve, what do you think the answer is?
John Kennedy.
Ken, John Kennedy.
John Kennedy, Howard.
Yes, sir. That's it.
John Kennedy is the correct answer.
That is the correct answer.
John Kennedy did lose the state of Ohio, but he did win the presidency, although a lot of Republicans to this day still think it was stolen. But it was John Kennedy is the correct answer. Now, before that, just for the record, it was Franklin Roosevelt in 1944, but one of the reasons for that is that John Bricker, Ohio's governor at the time, was on the national ticket.
Who was the last Ohioan to be on the national ticket.
That's right. That's right. Unless we include Vice President John Glenn. Oh, no, John Glenn.
Oh, no, that didn't work out, sorry.
No, it didn't work out.
All right, Steve, if you will stay on the line, and we'll get somebody to get your address and send you a fabulous prize for getting the correct answer.
Well, thank you.
And again, you can join our conversation as we talk about the partial government shutdown, 513-419-7100, 513-419-7100. 7100, your chance to talk about that with Ken Rudin, maybe ask a question or offer your thoughts on who you think the winners or the losers were in the recent shutdown. Where do we place, I mean, we talked earlier about the battle in the Senate between Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and Ted Cruz. For Ted Cruz, was this a battle about the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare or to raise the national profile of Ted Cruz?
Well, I think, I mean, my answer would be yes. I mean, because in his heart of hearts, he did want Obamacare repealed, as did probably almost every Republican in the House and Senate. I mean, no Republican likes the Affordable Care Act. They think that it's rife with errors, with problems. It's too expensive. It'll lead to higher costs. So there's no question that they all are opposed to it. But, you know, Ted Cruz did it in such a way that really it drew attention to him. His 21-hour talk-a-thon was not intended to stop any vote. He just, you know, it didn't really accomplish anything, except now everybody knows who Ted Cruz is. And if you look at some new numbers coming out of Texas, I mean, he is godlike down there. For all the poor numbers he has nationally, and there's no question that many of his Republican colleagues in the Senate despise him, but go down to Texas, he's the most popular guy in the state.
Yeah.
Let's talk, before we go to a break, just briefly, we'll start on this and then talk more about it after the break. Was it a surprise to you that when this started, it looked like Mitch McConnell was going to sit on the sideline, and then when push come to shove for a deal to come together, it was Mitch McConnell and Majority Leader Harry Reid who worked on the agreement. Was that surprising that Mitch McConnell took the lead role in coming up with this agreement that ended, at least temporarily, the shutdown and raised the debt ceiling?
I think he took the lead because nobody else was coming forward. Mitch McConnell, as everybody knows, has a very strong or potentially strong Democratic challenger and next year, the Secretary of State, and he also has a Tea Party challenge in the next May primary. So Mitch McConnell does have election concerns back home. I mean, we've always counted him out in the past, and he always manages to survive. But clearly, you know, maybe this time his time is up. But John Boehner didn't do the job. The House Republicans didn't do the job. Susan Collins, the moderate Republican senator from Maine, tried to forge a compromise, but Harry Reid would not allow any Democrat to sign on to that. So ultimately, Mitch McConnell rode to the rescue in spite of what his hesitations were. And while he probably didn't get much out of it, and we could talk about how much he did gain, but it really, once again, McConnell seems to be one of the adults in the room who says, okay, enough of this, you know, the silliness, the fun and games are over. Now it's time to be like an adult and sign a deal. And there was a deal. I mean, Harry Reid probably got everything he wanted, except the sequestration cuts are still in effect. But nobody had the wherewithal to do it on the Republican side, except for Mitch McConnell.
We're talking with political junkie Ken Rudin, and we'll continue that conversation in just a moment. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman with Howard Wilkinson. Our guest today is political junkie Ken Rudin, and we're talking about the aftermath of the federal government shutdown and what it means for Democrats and Republicans. You can join the conversation, share your thoughts on the shutdown, or ask Ken a politics question, 513-419-7100, or email talk at wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, 513-419-7100. And I want to let you know that Ken now has a podcast, and his website will be launching later today, which is KenRudinPolitics.com. You'll find links to both of those at WVXU.org. And Ken, why don't you tell us, folks go to KenRudinPolitics.com, what are they going to find there?
I have no idea. No, actually, Jay, no, I'm very excited about this. I think this is basically
we have the rest of the day to figure it out.
Right. Well, you know, it's my web page are the same people who's designing the healthcare web page, so there could be some problem there. But no, I'm very excited. All the stuff I did for so many years with NPR, my weekly political junkie column, daily updates on the blog, my very popular, though questionable, scuttle button puzzle, which people really enjoyed, is up there as well. And it'll also have links to the podcast and my Political Junkie program, which we recorded on Tuesday. We're going to do that every week as well.
And your podcast is there. And the first one is somebody that probably is going to be familiar to folks who listen to WVXU. It's Ron Elving with NPR.
Yes, he used to, the last I heard, he used to be my partner on the It's All Politics podcast. I haven't heard much about him lately. I don't know what his how his career is doing after we stopped doing the podcast. But no, Ron and I, look, you know, we get along so well. I've worked with him for so many years, and we had a great conversation. Again, you know, the segment that we're offering to member stations is 8 minutes, but the full podcast is 20 minutes, and we just have a lot of fun because we, the two of us, we deeply, deeply have faith in something called the political system, and we love the trivia, we love the history, but, you know, if somebody is doing something kind of goofy, we point that out as well.
And the podcast, you're going to do that once a week, is that correct?
Once a week, that's correct, yep.
Okay.
Hey,
there's a trivia question in the podcast, and there's a This Day in Campaign History, and lots of music, lots of fun stuff.
Let's go back to McConnell for just a minute. The day after this deal happened, Senate Conservatives Fund, was founded by Jim DeMint, immediately comes out and endorses Matt Bevins, the guy that's running, the Tea Party back guy who's running against McConnell in the primary. I don't know what that means, except that there is some money behind that, money people behind that. And this guy Bevins, who a couple months ago was a total unknown, is suddenly everywhere. He's on TV. He's all over the state. Is this a serious challenge, or is this just an annoyance?
Well, I think the McConnell people right now publicly are saying it's an annoyance. It's maybe even just a speed bump. But you don't, you can never tell. Remember, back in 2010, Charlie Crist was the governor of Florida, the clear favorite to be the next senator, and some guy named Marco Rubio was challenging him in the primary, and everybody said, "Oh, this is just a nuisance." And ultimately, the nuisance grew so big that Charlie Crist had to leave the Republican Party because he had no chance of winning it. McConnell is smart; he knows what's going on. He'll do everything he can to win. But we have seen surprises. You know, anytime the conservatives back a candidate, whether it's the Heritage Fund or the Club for Growth or anybody like that, you know they have a chance. You know they have ideologues behind them. You know they have money behind them. But McConnell also has money behind them. He always has. He has $10 million in the bank now.
Right.
And the difficulty, of course, for McConnell is that he can't move well to the right to blunt Matt Bevin's challenge because he has Alison Lundgren Grimes, the Democrat, waiting for him in November. So, but, you know, he's like, I mean, when I think of the word canny and savvy, whatever you think of Mitch McConnell, he's certainly canny and savvy. And so he'll do what it takes to win. Is he the favorite? Yes.
And the other thing you think of is tough as nails. I mean, he says, you know, you throw a pebble at me, I'm going to throw a boulder at you.
That's exactly right. And there were so many times we've counted him out. We said, okay, this is his last stand. You know, in 1990, we thought he'd lose. 2008, he had a very, very tough race that a lot of people thought he would lose until the end. So, you know, you got to watch him. And is he the most vulnerable Republican Senate incumbent up in 2014? Yes, but, you know, he manages to survive somehow.
There was an Associated Press story that I saw yesterday. I believe it came to us through the Courier-Journal out of Louisville that McConnell was being praised by Democrats and on editorial pages across Kentucky for, you know, coming up with this deal. How long will that Democratic praise last? Through the primary and then it's over, or will it end much sooner than that?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I'm kind of thinking that the reason the Democrats are saying such nice things about him is that it brings money to Matt Bevin's campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and you're absolutely right, the moment that primary is over, and should McConnell survive, as I think he does, but the moment that's over, he says, well, you know, something, we're not that crazy about him after all. And again, you know, things will change. There'll be more crises. There'll be more criticism of Obama from McConnell. And so, you know, things will keep changing and moving on, but it'll be interesting to see the kind of praise he gets from Democrats before the May primary and after.
Can the Republicans look at the shutdown and say they won anything?
Well, McConnell will say, and I think with some justification, McConnell will say that the one thing the Democrats desperately wanted to get rid of, and not that they were going to succeed in this, but what they desperately wanted to get rid of was the sequestration cuts that actually McConnell himself helped bring into being with his deals with Vice President Biden and things like that. If there's anything that shows a cut in government funding, it's the sequestration, and that's still in effect. Now, of course, the Democrats would have liked to have gotten rid of it, and the Republicans were never going to let that happen. But, of course, the Republicans didn't get anything else out of it as well. And for all the talks about how Democrats have got to agree to entitlement cuts, like in Social Security and Medicare, you know, Chuck Schumer and other Democrats say the only way that's going to happen if there's, you know, some movement on the revenue side. And McConnell and Boehner said there's absolutely no way that taxes are going to be raised. So I don't know how much movement there will be during these upcoming budget talks.
These budget talks are really what's supposed to happen every year. The House passes a budget, the Senate passes a budget, and then it goes to a conference committee where they work out a budget. And I think I heard the last time that happened was 2009. Yeah. So, and there was also, what, a super committee a couple of years ago that was supposed to do sort of the same thing. How likely is it that there's going to be some sort of agreement by mid-December?
Well, that's the deadline, and of course, we've seen deadlines come and go in the past, and we do know that both Boehner and McConnell say whatever happens, the discussion of a government shutdown is absolutely off the table. That's not going to happen. And there's going to be a lot of pressure on Paul Ryan, you know, Mitt Romney's running mate. You remember Mitt Romney was the guy who ran for president in 2012?
It's been so long ago.
He was in all the papers.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what happened to him since, but a lot of people may have forgotten who he was. Anyway, Paul Ryan was his running mate, the chairman of the House Budget Committee, and with a big future in front of him. He's looking to say, look, you know, whatever, we could talk about, you know, raising taxes, which is not going to go anywhere, but we could talk about this government spending that is getting out of control and is spiraling, and even Democrats acknowledge the fact that Social Security may not be sustainable in the coming years without some kind of drastic revising of what we're paying for all these things. So let's watch him. Let's watch Patty Murray, the Democratic counterpart in the Senate, and to see what happens. But I think the theatrics may not be there, but the issues, the philosophical issues between the two parties are going to remain.
Yeah, Rob Portman, the junior senator from Ohio, says that this will be the Republicans' opportunity to get back on their feet, you know, when this comes along. Do you see that as a possibility?
Yeah, I think there's truth to it, because I think as Ryan is not, I mean, you know, Ryan is very conservative and all those things, but then, you know, if you look at what the public has to say about the Affordable Care Act, they're not happy with it. They may not want it repealed, but they're not happy with it. The glitches and the problems with the launching of it, you know, on October 1st, with the website problems, that has not made it any easier. Had the Republicans not done something so drastically as to shut down the government, perhaps, you know, their numbers would be much improved and Obama and the Democrats' numbers would be much, you know, sinking fast. So they still think they have the issue on their side. The question is whether they can regain the trust of the American people to make their case.
There was an interview, I think it aired last Friday. NPR sent reporters out across the country to some of the things that had been shut down. And one of the places they sent a reporter was to the Liberty Bell. And the guy said basically he was upset with the partial shutdown. And he wasn't even sure that the Congress that we have right now could have written our Constitution. What's your thought on that? Could the current setup and the politics that we have now, could they have formed our country and written our Constitution?
Wow! Look, they can't even agree on a motion to end the day. You know, a motion to approve the minutes of the previous session. The dislike is just deep. We've talked about historically, you know, over the last few decades, even centuries, how the parties have disagreed. But this seems to, talking across party aisles seems to be a non-starter from the get-go. You could blame the Tea Party in 2010. You could blame the opposition to Bush. You could even go back to, you know, the Clarence Thomas matters, the Robert Bork matters. Everybody will point to a time when the animus between the two parties really, really increased. But the point is, they're not talking to each other. Those Republicans and Democrats who enjoy or who have interest in crossing lines and talking to folks on the other side are automatically threatened with a primary challenge from the right and left. And I don't know what the answer is. I mean, nobody's calling. Everybody says, I hate the two parties if it was only a third party. But, you know, no third party guy ever comes forward. You have to have a ton of money. And the last guy with a ton of money to come forward with a third party was Ross Perot. And, I mean, had Ross Perot been from the planet Earth, maybe, you know, he would have accomplished something. But, you know, they were false with Ross Perot as well. So I don't know what the alternative is. And I hope it's not some kind of a cataclysmic crisis that says, okay, now we have to get serious and now we have to be adults.
We did have an email from Daryl, who you mentioned a third party. He asked, has the stage been set for the rise of a strong third party? And his question was possibly a centrist party.
Well, they tried to do that in 2012. They were kind of begging everybody. Colin Powell's name was mentioned a lot of times. Michael Bloomberg, the mayor of New York City, his name was mentioned. People were imploring them. You know, they were signing petitions. Please save us from the extremes of the two parties. But nobody seemed to come through, come forward. Obviously, whoever would do that would probably end their careers or hope to have a career within their respective parties. But then Bloomberg is still maybe, you know, maybe in his mind he still would love the thought of it, but he's getting much older, and I don't know. I mean, you have to sacrifice a lot. You have to, and there's also a thing about the debates, whether you can get into the debates. It seems to be almost like a fixed, you know, game. The game is fixed from the beginning for the two parties, and it's so difficult for a third party to make any kind of difference. You know, the Libertarians do get on all 50 states, and I think the Green Party's on a whole bunch of states too, enough to get 270 electoral votes. But, you know, you think of the $60 million that Ross Perot spent and the 19 million votes he got, and how many electoral votes did he get? He got zero. So the name of the game is 270 electoral votes, and if you can't, you know, you don't come have a pathway to getting that, you're not going to, very few people are going to risk everything to make the run.
Yeah, there was a Washington Post poll, Washington Post ABC News polls looking at the Tea Party, and there's always been this question about, you know, whether the Tea Party is a tail wagging the dog in the Republican Party. This thing showed a record low support among population in general about the Tea Party, but there was like 34% of Republicans who said that they are no longer have a favorable opinion of the Tea Party. Are they ever going to cut these people loose?
Well, who's going to cut who loose? And that's the real question.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, John Boehner would not be Speaker of the House if it weren't for the Tea Party and the
right.
enthusiasm, or maybe the anger against Obama in 2010. But he owes the Tea Party the speakership. But, of course, what brings John Boehner down could be the Tea Party as well. Look, they're still Republicans. They still vote in Republican primaries. But it's interesting, when you think of all the Tea Party folks in 2010, they went after vulnerable Democrats. A lot of them were even centrist and blue dog Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
But in more recent years, every time you hear about Tea Party groups, they're attacking fellow Republicans. They're challenging fellow Republicans in primaries. You know, if you're seen as a squish, if you're seen as a rhino, if you're seen as too accommodating, you know, you'll be challenged by either a Heritage Group-backed or a Club for Growth-backed Tea Party kind of candidate. Now, if there are more Richard Lugar incidents, in other words, if there are more occasions where the Tea Party knocks off Republican incumbents and then they lose the seat to Democrats in November, maybe more and
right.
more Republicans will say enough is enough.
Yeah, I mean, that Tea Party support, you're right, did make John Boehner Speaker, but that was a double-edged sword. I mean, it can put you there, but it can also take you out.
Yeah, no, there's no question about that. I mean, they've made life miserable for Boehner. Newt Gingrich said the other day that with all the problems he had, and he had a lot of problems during his time as Speaker, he doesn't have nearly the kind of stuff that's going on with John Boehner, especially
yeah.
with his own party.
513-419-7100. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. If you have a question for Ken, or also you can share your thoughts about the shutdown, who the winners and the losers were in the recent fight. And Fred is calling from Sharonville. Fred, go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having Ken. It's a pleasure to speak with you. Question for you would be around open primaries. What do you think the possibilities or benefits are of going to like a top two or top four primary so that it might move the candidates more to the center so they don't have to worry about being outflanked on their right or left? I'd be interested in your comments.
Well, Yeah, that's certainly what's going on. That's certainly the law in California, and basically all the candidates, regardless of party, are on the same ballot, and then the voters pick two in the, I don't know if you call it a primary or the initial election, and then the top two finishers, regardless of party, move on to the runoff, the general election in November. I think there's truth to that. I think that it will increase. It'll probably increase moderate candidates, especially on the Republican side, for participating. Now, the argument against that is that it eliminates the libertarians and the socialist workers and the Green Party and all the Reform Party, all the third party guys who have always been on the ballot all along. Those people would be eliminated because they'll just be the top two finishers. And there's an argument to be said that that's not good for those fledgling parties. But of course, those parties don't make much of a difference anyway. I think it would result in more centrist candidates. But again, the Republican Party is a conservative party, and there are a lot of people, well, both on the right and the left, who feel that the nominee should be decided by members of their own party. So you do have centrists every now and then. Schwarzenegger was all for it in California, and that may be the wave of the future. But certainly the ideologues in both parties are totally against it.
And it is the way we elect the mayor in Cincinnati.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's a nonpartisan election. Exactly.
Nonpartisan right. Primary.
Fred, we appreciate the call. We're talking today with political junkie Ken Rudin, and we'll continue our discussion in just a moment. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman with Howard Wilkinson. We're talking politics today with political junkie Ken Rudin. Again, you can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100 or emailing talk at wvxu.org. You'll also find us on Facebook and Twitter, 513-419-7100. Ken, when we look to 2014, we talk about safe House seats. And a lot of times we hear that that's because of gerrymandering. There was a couple of analysts talking about this after the shutdown and said, yeah, that's part of it. But people who tend to be conservative tend to live in the same area with other conservatives. Same thing with those who tend to be more liberal tend to live in areas with more liberals. So while there may be gerrymandering, are voters helping that by grouping themselves together in neighborhoods and areas with fellow conservatives and liberals?
Well, that's an interesting way of looking at it. I mean, I think that's the case with many, you know, areas around the country, that people just live with among people who think and look like themselves. So that's probably one of the things as well. I think, look, everybody talks about gerrymandering and how the Republicans have the deck fixed. But, you know, that's always been the case, not with Republicans, but if you control the governorship, you control the state legislature, you draw the lines. Ohio is very good for the Republicans. The lines were very good for Republicans in 2012 because you have a Republican governor, a Republican legislature, and they did whatever they can to weaken Democratic candidates. But go next door to Illinois, and, you know, the Democrats control the governorship there, the state legislature there, and it was Republicans who paid the price big in Illinois in 2012. So, you know, this is not a new phenomenon with how elections are decided. But the thing that is different is that once upon a time, districts were in such a way that it was like 53-47 or 52-48, one party or the other. Now it's very often it's 70-30. So when you have a 70-30 district and you're a Democrat incumbent or a Republican incumbent, there's no reason for you to compromise. There's no reason for you to try to come up with a nonpartisan or at least a bipartisan solution. You really have to worry about your base. You have to worry about your primary. And that ultimately is not good for the country.
And those 53-47% districts are very difficult to draw.
They are. You know, there's a bunch of states. I know Arizona has it. I know Iowa has it. I know there are some other states that are talking about it where they have independent commissions, not the state legislature drawing the districts, but independent commissions
right.
to draw them to make fair fights. And, you know, like the other caller who talked about, the top two finishers, in the elections, this may be the way of redrawing districts. And if that's the case, one, you'll have much more vigorous elections and more reasons to seek out support from the opposite party voters.
We've tried that in Ohio, and voters have turned it down, though.
Yeah.
513-419-7100, and Tom is calling from Wilder. Tom, go ahead.
Well, good afternoon, gentlemen. I have an idea that I would like to throw out that has to do with the seating of the members of the House. Right now, I understand that they are seated with the Republicans on one side, Democrats on the other. What if they were assigned seats at random so that the representatives of different parties would be distributed kind of equally across the whole House and give everybody an opportunity to have informal conversations, and it would be less of a confrontational setup? And I just throw that out for comments.
Ken, well, I know that has happened sometimes during State of the Union speeches, but the rest of the time, I think that's a lot of times people have this image that all the House members are gathered in the chamber at one time.
They don't spend that much time.
But they're really not there.
Right.
Well, that's true, too. But, of course, when you have a State of the Union or a major speech, they are divided by parties. The last time I could recall that happening, and that's an interesting idea, Tom, but the last time I remember, it was in the aftermath of the Gabrielle Giffords shooting, and there was a House thing, and Democrats and Republicans were sitting next to each other. There was a camaraderie. There was a comity between the two parties, and everybody was saying, this is really great. We should do this more often, and that plan lasted all of 15 minutes, and then they went back to the hooting and hollering. I think most members like to sit with their own. I think that, you know, when President Obama would have a State of the Union, the Democrats would launch their feet with applause. The Republicans would sit in silence. It would be kind of interesting. It's kind of great on television to see one side jumping up and the other side's, you know, sitting and grumbling, regardless, you know, regarding who's president.
Or making faces,
Or making faces, or in the case of Joe Wilson of South Carolina yelling, you lie. I mean, I can't imagine him doing that if he was sitting next to a Democrat. But I don't think it's something that'll happen anytime soon, but it may be one of the ways that, you know, there was a congressman named Vern Ehlers, who I knew from Michigan, who retired a few years back. And he said in the old days, forget about what it was like, the rancor on the floor. In the old days, they wouldn't go immediately home to their home districts. They would stay in Washington. They would go to their offices. They would open up a drawer and a bottle of bourbon, and they would just socialize with members of the other party. In the old days, you know, Tom Foley, the House Speaker, who just died last week, he was one of those guys who, he was a partisan, but he had great respect for Bob Michael, his Republican counterpart. Democrats and Republicans socialized and talked with each other back then, and they certainly don't do that now.
Well, there's the old stories about, you know, Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan, you know, going after each other all day long, and then Tip would get in a limousine after the day was over, go down to the White House, and they'd open up a bottle of scotch and talk.
That's true, even though both sides will tell you Reagan and Tip O'Neill couldn't stand each other. But at least they talked.
But they talked, yeah.
Right.
Before we move on from the shutdown, again, the budget conferees are talking and supposed to have some sort of agreement by mid-December, which I guess we could sort of refer to as Grand Bargain 3.0. What are your thoughts on, you know, this elusive grand bargain? Is the timing right that something could come from these talks?
Honestly, I don't think so. And, you know, you think, well, the Republicans were chastened after the last crisis. Maybe they'll be say, okay, we're not going to hold to our guns. But Harry Reid and President Obama and the Democrats didn't make it easier at all for the Republicans to say, okay, you know, we'll let bygones be bygones. Harry Reid refused to allow any Democrat to work on a compromise position with Susan Collins, because he just wanted to exact everything for his side. As soon as it was over, well, even though President Obama said there were no winners here, he just said, look, you know, Republicans, if you, you know, maybe if you won some elections, you know, you'll get your way. So I think the well is still poisoned. I really don't know how the mood has changed, aside from the fact that you have adults like McConnell and even Boehner saying, forget about the shutdown. But But the blood is still, it's just not a good situation. And I don't know, you know, the Republicans are not going to raise taxes, and the Democrats are not going to cut entitlements unless the Republicans raise taxes. I don't know what gets accomplished, but so I don't know. I just don't know.
An AP article off the wire that I got before the show started. Key contractors on the troubledhealthcare.gov website tell Congress the bugs can be fixed and won't prevent uninsured Americans from getting coverage. What's the political fallout from the rollout of the Affordable Care Act?
Well, the Republicans, I think, feel they have an issue, and there's some legitimacy to that argument. I mean, a lot of people think that all they had to do was don't shut down the government, just let the ACA, you know, the Affordable Care Act, sink under its own problems. Now, I don't think it's going to sink. I think these web problems, these glitches, are temporary. But look, President Obama just, you know, he says they're unacceptable. There's no excuse. And Democrats are livid because here they are. They passed this bill 3 years ago. President Obama and the Democrats have been touting this bill for 3 years. It went through a Supreme Court decision. It went through a presidential election. It's already, you know, the law of the land. And as it's coming out, and it doesn't work. So the Democrats are humiliated. President Obama is humiliated. The Republicans think they have a new issue to battle on. Of course, there are other things. People are saying, okay, enough already with the Obamacare. But I think, you know, there are millions of people who have been turned down or dissuaded to sign up because of problems with the website. And and the Republicans are desperately trying to get back on the offensive next week. The House Energy and Commerce Committee is going to have Kathleen Sebelius, the secretary of the Health and Human Services, which is responsible for Obamacare, and she's really under the gun. I mean, you know, I think back to President George W. Bush saying, you know, you did a heck of a job, Brownie, when Michael Brown and FEMA in the wake of Katrina, and then of course he resigned not much longer. Obviously, some Republicans are demanding Sebelius. Is resignation. I don't know if that's going to happen. Obama and Sebelius are pretty close. She endorsed President Obama early in the 2008 campaign, even though Hillary Clinton was running for president. So there is some loyalty there. But, you know, you always hear about somebody getting thrown under the bus, and you wonder if she's the one. But the Republicans do feel they have an issue here.
She may well be the one. Kathleen Sebelius is a native Cincinnatian, number one. But, you know, she was here last week and was saying, oh, well, you know, there's some glitches, there are some problems, we're working it out, and telling people, well, you have until March anyway, so don't worry about it, you've got plenty of time. Now, I saw a few hours ago, Rob Portman was here in town. I went and talked to him about it. He's not calling for her head, but he is saying that the whole system has to be delayed. Everything needs to be shut down until they work this out, work out the bugs in the system, and get it so it's operating. And obviously, Portman's, you know, is opposed to Obamacare.
But he's not a bomb thrower.
Yeah, but he's not a bomb thrower, and he's not the kind who calls for somebody's head. But he says we need to put a hiatus on this until we can work out these problems. Does that seem to be the consensus that's kind of forming in Washington?
Well, certainly in the Republican Party. And the irony is
Democrats
that was one of the demands that the Republicans in the House made for continuing to fund the government. We'll vote yes if you delay or defund Obamacare for a year. Now, again, had they not shut down the government and had they not made their bad numbers even worse, perhaps the Republican Party, I'm talking politically now, of course, but perhaps the Republican Party would have been, you know, with the public, you know, backing them, saying that this is a disaster, it just didn't start out right, it came out too soon, and so it has to be delayed. But now when you hear, again, delay for another year, there are a lot of people say, oh, the Republicans are still beating that dead horse. But the point is, it's just there are serious, serious problems with it, and For a system that was supposed to be in place for all these years, you know, 3 years or so since the signing of it, it is, in Obama's words, unacceptable.
Part of the Affordable Care Act was the idea of states were given the option to expand their Medicaid program, and Ohio Governor John Kasich has been pushing that. The Republican-controlled legislature here in the state has been opposed to that. So this week, Kasich went to the state controlling board and got a 5-2 vote to expand Medicaid. That's now going to be tied up in lawsuits. How politically risky was that for Kasich to do that for a first-term governor who's going to be up for re-election next year?
Well, you know, it's a remarkable thing to watch. When you think of John Kasich, I mean, who's more conservative than John Kasich? John Kasich was the Tea Party before there was a Tea Party. He was running when he ran for president or tried to run for president in 1999. I mean, this was a staunch conservative, but he was also pragmatic. I mean, he was chairman of the House Budget Committee. He knew what he was doing. He knew how things worked. Since obviously he has designs on a second term in 2014, perhaps he has designs on something bigger in 2016. But the point is, for him to pick a fight, I mean, this was probably unavoidable, but for him to have this fight with conservatives in his own party, I mean, who knows what the political climate is going to be like in 2014, but it's very surprising. I mean, you know, we talk about the divisions in the Republican Party in Washington. Well, they're obviously there in Columbus as well. And John Kasich and his fellow Republicans are no different.
And he did this by totally bypassing the legislature, which is controlled by his own party.
Obviously they seemed like they were not going to give in at all.
No, they weren't going to give in at all.
Right.
And this was the only way. And he kept couching it in moral terms. I mean, almost biblical terms, you know, that we have a responsibility to these people to, you know, to help those who are the least among us. And he kept making that argument. And it was appealing to Democrats, and I think it was appealing to a lot of independent voters. Whether or not it was falling on deaf ears among Republican voters, I'm not sure.
Well, I haven't seen, you know, like with McConnell, see, you know, the Democrats praising McConnell to egg on the Tea Party. I haven't seen any kind of a public challenge for Kasich in the 2014 primary. And while that could happen, I don't know if it's going to happen. But it's just interesting to see that, you know, this is a guy who was going to take a united Ohio Party. And look, the Ohio Republican Party historically has always been powerful and one of the most powerful Republican machines in the country.
Oh, yes.
The thought of Kasich having a divided party going into 2014 is definitely not anything he thought would be possible when he was first elected.
And the Tea Party people are furious about it. It was two right-to-life organizations and a number of Tea Party-backed legislators who took him to court now after that.
Right.
Ken, here in about a minute, what about any thoughts on the sudden popularity of Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear? He's been on a number of national programs. I believe he was on an NPR show. He was on CNN, MSNBC, talking about how well Obamacare is working in Kentucky. Any thoughts that could mean anything for him politically, even though he says he's done?
Well, you know, I mean, he's 69 years old. He's ending his second and final term as governor of Kentucky. Remember back in 96, he lost to Mitch McConnell pretty convincingly. It's interesting. Kentucky is always a fascinating state because, you know, growing up, I didn't grow up in Kentucky. I grew up near Kentucky in the Bronx. But, I mean, reading about Kentucky as a kid, you know, you always thought of it as a Democratic state. And it still continues, even though it's socially conservative, it continues to elect Democratic governors. But, of course, as we know, it also elects Republican senators, Mitch McConnell and Rand Paul, the latest bunch. Look, it's working in Kentucky. I don't know if it's the ACA that's working or is it Kinect or something. Is it called
Kinect?
Kinect.
Yeah.
Kinect. Which is the state insurance exchange program.
Right.
And it's successful. Now, only a third of the uninsured folks have signed up for it, and a lot of people are saying that it may not be as successful as President Obama and Governor Beshear are saying. But the point is, he has nothing to lose politically. He doesn't have to worry about a primary. He doesn't have to worry about re-election. And so he's free to be this champion.
And Ken, we're going to have to leave it there.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We've been talking politics with political junkie Ken Rudin, and he'll be our guest again next month for another chat. A reminder that he does have a podcast, and his website will be launching later today, which is kenrudinpolitics.com. And you'll find links to both of those at wvxu.org. Ken, thanks for joining us.
You know, if you didn't interrupt me, I would have still been talking even if, after we hung up.
Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. Producer for today's program was Pete Reitmeier. Our technical director was Rick Andrus. With Howard Wilkinson, I'm Jay Hanselman.